Honorable members, members of the media, you are all welcome. I'll just ask Mrs. Pillay to brief us on the approach that we are going to follow and make sure that we are all in agreement. Because I can see some people are getting scared of the volumes that are before us. Mrs. Pillay.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, honourable members. Chair, firstly, let me introduce the team that's with me. I think we've met them before, but it's Mr. Roberta and Mr. Mangena, who are working on the drafting of the bill. So they will be primarily dealing with the comments. And I thought that maybe I should introduce how we're going to approach the matter today, because you would have seen a very big pile of responses to comments. And I just want to say, not to be daunted by that thick stack of documents, because we took an approach firstly in responding to give you as much information as possible and as much research as possible, because there are some weighty issues that were raised during the comment phase. That's the first point I want to make. The second point is that we felt it necessary to respond to all the comments and not leave out any comments. So that is why the document is so lengthy. But what we'll do when we are responding, we will not repeat the comments. We've kind of grouped the comments together, and those that where we respond and that are repeated, we will not necessarily go into it in the deliberations. So the document is with you. You can study it as we start today. The next issue I want to raise is that you will find that when you look at the bill and when you look at the comments, we've done the comments per chapter, and we have a general introduction on general comments that came through. We will start with the general comments, but when you consider the bill, you'll find that there are five major sections to the bill. The first section is on cybercrime, where we create the offences of cybercrime and all the relevant parts thereto. The second important section that we thought we would just ring-fence is malicious communications. Then we move on to the issue of the processes, and that's where we deal with the search and seizure provisions and the international cooperation. And then the fourth part is where we deal with the structures, that's the Cyber Response Committee and the 24/7, etc. And the fifth part, which we don't want to lose sight of, and is quite substantial as well, is the schedule. Because in the schedule, we make very important amendments to other legislation, and in that regard, I want to raise in particular the Sexual Offences Act, where we deal with pornography. And I think that's a very important section, so let's also deal with that. But we will get to those sections. Then the other point that I want to raise in the introduction is what were the key issues that came out during the comments. I think we need to focus on the following. Firstly, it was the issue of privacy, whether the bill encroaches on the right to privacy, and you'll find that we deal quite extensively with that. We also refer to case law, international case law as well. So we will take you through that as we go through the document, but the references are in the comments. The next important area of the bill is the search and seizure provisions, because I think there were issues raised about the constitutionality of that and the encroachment into the rights, etc. Those are very important provisions as well, so we're going to focus on that. The other comments that came through was about the cost to implement the bill. There were a few questions about that, and then we would deal, because I think it's very important to look at the issue of implementation as we go through the bill and ask you to consider it. The other point is, how does this bill, how does the clauses of this bill interact with other provisions of other legislation? There are two pieces of proposed legislation which is to be considered or still or being considered by Parliament at this stage. That is the Critical Infrastructure Bill and the Hate Crimes Bill, which our department has not introduced as yet, but is in the process of doing so. The other pieces of legislation that have been passed is the Protection from Harassment and the Sexual Offences Act, which is both legislation with falling within the justice portfolio. And then there's the Film and Publication Act in relation to the pornography, child pornography provisions. So we're also going to be touching on those areas because there was some comment about that, that this bill actually deals with those issues and is it necessary for it to be dealt here. So those are the points that I want to raise in the introduction. Chair, so I'm not sure whether you would want us to deliberate on how we go forward because it is the documents are lengthy, but as I said, it follows the themes that I've just highlighted.
Are we all able to hear? We seem to be so scattered. Can you hear what she's saying or do you need to get nearer? Maybe you should get nearer, or otherwise. Are you fine? You're
yes,
able
yes.
to hear?
The speakers are here, Chair. We can hear.
Okay, no, that's fine. Are we happy with the approach? Yeah, the. Doesn't seem to be any problem, so you may proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. The first part of the comments and responses is the general comments on the bill. 40 persons did give written submissions on the bill, and most of that persons or entities also made oral submissions in Parliament. In the comments and responses, everything that we received as well as the issues that were raised during the oral discussions of the bill or submissions to Parliament were taken into account. So I'm going to start off with the first part of the comment and responses, and that is the general clauses. On page 4, on there, first comment that we received relates to standard and capacity of forensic investigators, but it also relates to other capacity shortcomings that is foreseen by some people. Our response to that is that the National Cybercrime Policy Framework and the bill makes provision for the necessary development of capacity in this regard. Paragraph 12 of the NCPF specifically stated that South Africa must develop the necessary capacity. Clause 54 of the bill imposes obligations on various departments. Firstly, to get the necessary capacity to give effect to their mandates in terms of the bill. And it also imposes obligations on departments to develop specific training courses with higher educational institutions to train their members. It must be remembered that even highly developed countries in the world do suffer from capacity insofar as it relates to cybercrime and cybersecurity. I believe America and the UK only recently come to grips with the capacity shortage. Insofar as it relates to the investigation of cyber crimes, one must remember that the bill in Chapter 5 that deals with the investigation of cyber crime do provide that the police may make use of investigators, which is not to say police official to help in the investigation of cybercrime. A reference was made to earlier to clauses 27.3, 30, 31, 4 of the bill. Second comment, it's a comment from ODAC in summary. They indicate the bill is necessary, but they also express a concern that the bill has significant powers to the Minister of State Security in this regard, page 5. The response thereto is that if this bill is considered as a whole, no powers. He is handed over to the Minister of State Security to infringe on privacy or communications per se. One must remember that in terms of the National Strategic Intelligence Act, the State Security Agency already has got a mandate to deal with critical infrastructure protection in South Africa. It's a vague empowerment in terms of that clause, or in terms of that act. Chapter 11 of the bill that deals with critical information infrastructure sets out the powers precisely how the State Security Agency must go about in securing critical information infrastructure in South Africa. In terms of the bill, Clause 53, the Cyber Response Committee is established. And the Cyber Response Committee is a committee that was given the task to implement the National Cybercrime Policy Framework of South Africa. That committee resort under the State Security Agency, more specifically the Director General of State Security. But one must take into account that the CRC is made up of various other departments with different constitutional mandates. And in the CRC, decisions will be taken on a consensual basis. And obviously, as a result of the fact that other departments have different mandates, and constitutional mandates that they must protect, it is admitted that that will balance the operation of the CRC. So it's our submission that the bill does not hand any powers to the Minister of State Security to interfere with communications, to provide backdoors into systems, or to intercept communications. If that is done in any case, and if it's not judicially authorized, the State Security Agency will commit offenses. I think RICO is there to ensure that interception of communications can only take place in terms of judicial authorization. Media monitoring, that is on page 6, paragraph 1.3, raises a concern that there is a lack of an overarching internet policy in South Africa that deals with the extent how information rights can be infringed upon by other legislation. My submission is that the Department of Telecommunications and Postal Services has enacted a comprehensive policy in this regard. It's called the National Integrated ICT Policy. And it's a very comprehensive policy. On one hand, it does deal with the protection of information rights, but even in that policy, it does recognize, on the one hand, cyber crimes need to be addressed, and certain essential critical information infrastructure need to be protected. In any case, everything that is done in terms of any legislation is subject to constitutional revision. Page 7, various parties did make submissions that the bill should also deal with copyright infringements. Our response to that is that the bill does not aim to deal with copyright infringements at all. South Africa has a copyright act which deals with copyright infringements, and it is submitted that the current copyright amendment bill that is before Parliament needs to cater for copyright infringements, and it's our submission that we must not address copyright infringements at all in terms of the bill. The problem is that one cannot merely criminalize copyright infringements. There's various policy issues that needs to be taken into account before you can deal with copyright infringement. So the criminal law was in general a blunt instrument to deal with copyright infringements. On page 8, there's a concern by one of the service providers regarding the cost of compliance regarding the bill, and also further the capacity of the state to deal with the structures that is established in terms of Chapter 10 of the Act. And they also raise the issue regarding how does the bill infringe on the Protection of Personal Information Act. Capacity has been discussed previously, so I'm not going to deal with that. Regarding cost implications, the bill will have cost implications for government as well as the private sector. But one must take into account the cost currently of cybercrime in South Africa and the negative results that emanates therefrom, as well as the losses that is being suffered. So our submission is, although there might be some cost implications to deal with the implementation of the bill, the cost implications is very limited. Regarding the right to privacy, which is actually protected by the Protection of Personal Information Act, one must take into account that although privacy is a constitutional right, it has been decided over and over by the courts that the right to privacy is not absolute and that it must at some stage lead to before the expectations of society to be protected against crime. Furthermore, our submission that POPI deals with privacy, but it cannot be interpreted to that extent that it can override a criminal investigation. On page 9, it is referred to by Deloitte that there is a significant increase in cybercrime. Paragraph 1.8 is the next comment which I want to address, and that relates to a comment that was received in written submissions as well as in oral submissions that was before Parliament, where a remark was made that the bill was not subject to a SAIAS process and that the department did not consult on the SAIAS. I did forward the final document, the certificate that was signed off by DPME, to indicate that the SAIAS on the bill has been done. And they did consider it.
Maybe, especially for me, maybe if you can unpack this SAIAS, what is it?
Yes, well, you use that comment just to help us understand what the
Chair, thank you. The SAIAS is the socio-economic impact system, which was approved by Cabinet for implementation in 2015. What it requires is that all legislation must be subject to a socio-economic impact assessment, meaning that you must test your bill against its socio-economic impact, and you need to also look into the cost of compliance, and you must do a cost-benefit analysis. So it's a new system that has been implemented, and as a department, we comply with it fully. And I think a lot of the members would may remember the regulatory impact assessment that was in place a while ago, and it was at that stage done through National Treasury. I think a lot of departments didn't comply fully with the regulatory impact assessment, and I think government wants to avoid a situation where you put in place a lot of legislation, but you find that you cannot implement them, and we don't fully understand the impact, the socioeconomic impact in particular. With the socioeconomic impact assessment, we are also looking at alignment with the National Development Plan and the goals in government and alignment to policy. What the process we follow is that we do an assessment. There's a template that has been prepared by DPME where you look at cost-benefit analysis and have you consulted, have you addressed the concerns that were raised during the consultation phase. You prepare a document and you get a sign-off certificate. And there's two processes. One, you do a preliminary say-off and then you do a final say-off after the consultation phase. And each of those phases, you get a sign-off certificate. The sign-off certificate is similar to a certification of a bill that you would get from the state law advisors. So there's a very stringent mechanism in place to ensure that we comply. And no bill can pass cabinet without a socioeconomic impact assessment.
Thank you. While we are there, let me welcome Mr. J.J. Skosana, a new member of the committee who replaces Mr. Bongo. Mr. Skosana, you are most welcome. Thank you. From the ANC.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Concern was raised that we did not consult on the SIOS. Ms. Pillay did indicate that it's part of the SIOS that we must indicate whether there was any consultation of the bill. We don't consult or go out for public consultation of a bill, of a SIOS. That is not necessary. But like you said, it's part of the SIOS that you must indicate you did consult with that. And the bill was extensively consulted upon. It was consulted on over a period of more than a year. It was considered by knowledgeable persons as well, and everybody did have a chance to give input in that regard. I'm going to move to page 10, paragraph 1.9. Concerns have been raised about onerous standards and the regulatory impact assessment. And Ms. Kalei has addressed that, so I'm going to skip that one. On page 11, all rise to welcome cyber harassment. And they also say that it's public education must take place. And our response there too is usually when a bill is implemented or in the process of being implemented, that there will be public awareness campaigns regarding the bill as a whole, as well as specific clauses in the bill in which the public have an interest. That was done, amongst others, in relation to the Domestic Violence Act, the Protection of Harassment Act, and insofar as it relates to malicious communications, the department will do an extensive awareness campaign on that chapter. Going to skip to paragraph 1.12, where concern is raised that the bill has many dependencies. Various departments is involved in the bill, and the concern is raised that that may affect the implementation of the bill due to the fact that it may be difficult for all the departments to come to terms with the obligations in terms of the bill. Our submission is that the bill has mainly three focus areas. The first part is the chapters that deals with cybercrime. Chapters 2 to 9, there is subordinate legislation that needs to be made in terms of that chapters. To an extent, some of the subordinate legislation were already drafted or are in the process of being drafted, pending final adoption of the bill. I refer, amongst others, to standard operating procedures and the extensive regulations that need to be enacted in terms of the malicious communications clauses of the bill. Capacity building is the other main focus area. Capacity building, our submission is that we have current capacity to implement the bill. One must remember, cybercrime and cybersecurity, this is probably the first time in South Africa that government has to deal comprehensively with this aspect. So we need to make a start somewhere. The bill places obligations on the department to sure that capacity is developed, and but I must stress there is current capacity to implement the bill. Regarding the third part, critical information infrastructure protection, it is dependent on the identification of critical information infrastructure, as well as issuing directives which will prescribe to critical information infrastructures how they must implement measures to protect themselves. Some steps has already been taken in this regard, pending the finalization of the bill. I must also point out that the bill do make provision for incremental implementation in the case where it becomes necessary. So we can, in terms of the bill, put other sections of the bill in operation if it is necessary. Let's move to page 12. Which do deal with cost implications for electronic communication service providers. That was to an extent already addressed. There will be some cost implications, but it will not be significant. On page 13 is important aspects that need to be considered. That is, a comment is made that a bill threatens digital rights in significant ways. And our submission thereto is that all the freedom of expression and confidentiality of communications are primary considerations, and users, their communications must obviously be protected. It must yield over before society's need to be protected against cybercrime. It's further our submission that the bill has various checks and balances in place to address any infringement of that rights and to ensure that that is not done in a way that is may have in a way that adversely affects that rights in an unconstitutional manner. On page 14, concern is raised that the bill provides powers to the state to monitor business and private cyber activities. Our submission that the bill does not in any way authorize the monitoring of any communications. One must remember there is a RICO legislation that strictly deals with monitoring and interception, and any person or entity that intercepts or monitors communications outside the ambit of RICO will commit serious offences. On page 14, paragraph D, concern is again raised that bill will impact on other legislation. I did explain it that the bill, other legislation must lead before the bill insofar as it relates to putting in place measures that aims to protect persons against cybercrime. So in general it's my submission that the bill will not impact on the Protection of Personal Information Act at all. Paragraph E on page 14, a concern is raised that the bill give the South African police greater powers to arrest persons. One must remember currently any investigation and arrest is regulated in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act. So there's already measures in place to arrest persons that do commit cyber crimes. But the Criminal Procedure Act has various shortcomings insofar as it relates to the investigation of cybercrime. And it's our submission that the Criminal Procedure Act does not have the necessary safeguards in place to deal with invasion of privacy during investigations. And it's our submission that the bill betters that position, but one must always remember it does not give the police additional extraordinary powers of arrest. That is already there. On page 15, concern is raised that the bill should also have taken into account new developments relating to electronic evidence. There was a report by the South African Law Reform Commission where they did make certain recommendations regarding the reform of digital evidence. The bill was introduced in Parliament before that report was finalised, so that was not taken into account. Currently, there is the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act that do deal with electronic evidence. And the South African Law Reform Commission report will be taken into account in the revision of the ECDA, and also possibly, I believe one of the suggestions was that a comprehensive bill be enacted to deal with digital evidence on its own. But that will be considered at a later stage. On page 15, on the bottom line, there's a concern that the bill provides a framework that undermines internet freedom overall and enable the state to interfere with devices and so forth. Our response thereto is, one must remember, the main aim of the bill is to rationalize all the current fragmentary cyber offences that is already on the statute book in a single coherent chapter that will deal with all cyber crimes. So, on the one hand, since cyber crimes were already on the statute book, it's our submission that it cannot actually be regarded as an interference due to the fact that the bill mainly aims to rationalise existing law. Insofar as it relates to Chapter 3, that deals with malicious communications, our submission is that malicious communications is also already criminalized to an extent on the statute book. To introduce or put it in a bill that specifically deal with cyber offenses can therefore not be, be seen as any additional interference of any rights. In any event, one can look at the legislation of various other countries. In the comment I did refer to Canada, Australia, the United Kingdom, they also put specific legislation on the statute book to deal with malicious communications. In general, all offences in the bill, in Chapter 2 of the bill, is recognised by most constitutional democracies in the world, as well as various countries in South Africa, in Africa amongst others. It's also part of the SADC model law. One can look at the AU Convention on Cybercrime and Protection of Personal Information, which also proposed that the conduct that is in Chapter 2 of the bill needs to be criminalised. It's our submission that from a criminalisation perspective, as well as an investigative perspective, that there is no real perceived or no real infringement of any rights. R2K on page 16 and the bottom, it's paragraph 18, remarks that a wrong approach is taken in South Africa relating to cybersecurity, which is a top-down approach and a state-centric approach. And they are of the opinion that this makes cyberspace less secure to ordinary users. Our response thereto is that various states or governments all over the world are involved in the protection or all states or governments worldwide is prime role players in ensuring that cyberspace is secure. In general, one must take into account that there is obligation on the state to protect its citizens as well as its own sovereignty. And government usually has the necessary resources to call together role players to deal with aspects relating to cyber security. And it's our submission that the approach is not incorrect or wrong per se. On page 17, reference is made by to three levels of protection, and the bill is evaluated against that. The first measurable protection, identified category of protection relates to the protection of information, and the commentator says that clause 2, which deals with unlawful access, undermines or overlaps with the protection of personal information legislation. And the remark is made that persons who, contrary to the provision of the POPIA, access data will be regarded as criminals in terms of the bill. And reference is made to the fact that the POPIA already contains certain measures to deal with infringement of personal information. Our response thereto is that unlawful access or any other of the offences in Chapter 2 of the Bill must not be equated with non-compliance with the provisions of the POPIA. POPIA aims to protect personal information that is processed by public or private bodies, by amongst others to introduce certain conditions for lawful processing. The offence contemplated in Clause 2 are aimed at securing computer systems and data, and that offence is also called the gating offence, the first important offence that needs to be criminalised in cybercrime, which give rise to all other cybercrimes. Our submission in general is that POPIA cannot deal with unlawful access. In any case, let's take the instance where a cyber criminal accesses a computer system. In terms of POPIA, there's basically two offences that can be regarded as criminal offences. It's section 105 and 106 of the POPIA. All the other offences that is created in the POPIA in section 59 is administrative offences that ensure that there is administrative compliance of the POPIA. So, in general, POPIA cannot be used to deal with unlawful access of computer systems. So, our submission is that that argument is completely wrong, and we cannot agree with that. The second level of protection that's referred to on page 19 relates to the securing of networks, and concern is raised mainly to the effect that government may, through the bill, ensure backdoors into networks to get access to information. A backdoor is more or less a procedure that's put in place to ensure that the state can surreptitiously access certain networks. Our submission is that the bill cannot be regarded as an instrument that in any way authorized the state to resort to such measures to get access to information. I think that comment was mainly made in relation to Chapter 11 of the bill that deals with the protection of critical information infrastructure. And if one evaluates that chapter in whole, as well as all the other provisions of the bill, there's no authority or no empowerment of the State Security Agency or the state in general to access any information. So it's our submission that that concern is also wrong. On page 20, the information regulator was before the committee and gave oral submissions, and he indicated that the bill was drafted before the office was established, and indicated that he wants to meet with certain departments in order to discuss aspects that may impact on his powers. Further on the discussion, any concerns that were raised by the information regulator will be discussed in respect of the area on which he made comment. On page 21, I'm going to skip to paragraph 121. We article say that cyber crimes should be redrafted to prevent any possible misuse, mainly to enable online censorship or stifle online public participation or to infringe on legitimate online activities. I believe that was already addressed previously. I did indicate that the aim of the bill is not in any way to try to infringe on information and communication rights of citizens. A concern is again raised regarding the fact that the implementation of the NCPF, that is on page 21-22, hands powers to the Minister of State Security to implement our cyber initiative. And I believe I did discuss it already, and indicate that the State Security Agency is merely the facilitator to implement the NCPF as well as the bill, and that they cannot control the outcome of the whole implementation process. On page 23, it's a concern that was raised by the Center for Constitutional Rights, and they indicate that the bill has or rather adversely affects certain constitutional rights. Again, it's our submission that the bill is in line with international norms and principles, and it's our submission that the perceived infringement is therefore also clearly wrong. The next comment which I want to address is on page 25. There's a concern, or not a concern, it was a suggestion by Mr. Hank that the committee must consider whether the state has the necessary skills to man the structures that is being proposed in the bill, as well as general skills that is available to the state. The general capacity requirements were already addressed. In terms of the bill, the structures that need to be established is the 24/7 point of contact. That is a structure that is under, that needs to be established by the South African Police Services. The aim of the 24/7 is to provide in the first on the one side for international cooperation, but on the other side also more or less to ensure that there's a central point for the investigation of cybercrime. It's our submission that the South African Police Services currently make use of the Interpol link to facilitate international cooperation. So to an extent, the 24/7 point of contact will help South African police to, at least insofar as it relates to cyber offences, develop specific capacity to man the 24/7. It's also submitted that there is current capacity to an extent that can be used to man the 24/7 point of contact. The other structure is the cyber response committee that needs to be established in terms of section 53 of the bill. That was discussed. It's a structure under given the task to implement the NCPF of South Africa. That structure is already functioning, so it's okay. The cyber hub is a further structure that needs to be established in terms of chapter 10 of the bill. The cyber hub has already been established. The cyber hub is functioning currently. And the cyber hub is mainly a link between government and the private sector. So there is capacity in the cyber hub to deal with its functions. Currently, there is a government cert that deals with cyber security in South Africa, which is situated in the State Security Agency. Our submission is that the current capacity can be used to expand on the current cert that is within the state security. So it's our submission that there is capacity to man the structures. In general, there is also capacity currently to investigate cyber crime. So I think the concern is not valid in that regard. And further on page 26, there's a call by Mr. Haynes that the bill be split in two. On the one hand, the part that deals with cybercrime must be a separate bill, and the second part must be the part of the bill that deals with cybersecurity. In the comment, I did put out to indicate the necessary building blocks of cybersecurity. As our submission, that the bill as a whole comply with that building blocks. If we split a bill into two, on the one hand, we do not address all the building blocks of cybersecurity simultaneously. One part can be delayed. So it's our submission that the bill should not be split into two bills. I'm going to skip to page 28. Where there's indication that the normal research and consultation process was not followed during the bill, and various other commentators did attest to the extensive consultation process that did take place, so I don't think that concern is valid in any way. There's also concern about the broad wording of the bill, that's on page 29. One must remember that the bill is a very technical bill, and it cannot be drafted in non-technical terms. One can look at the legislation of various other countries. It is technical. There is certain specific concepts that must be in a bill like this, and it cannot be described otherwise. So it's our submission that it's impossible to tone down on the technicality of the wording of the bill. I'm going to skip to page 31, and that more or less paragraph 133, where reference is made that the bill amend various other laws and certain unintended consequences may result from such an amendment. In the schedule of the bill, various other bills is amended and certain provisions of other legislation is repealed. As I already indicated, the bill aims to rationalize all the offenses and procedures in the other bills in a single bill. And I think it was done thoroughly, and it's our submission that there can be no unintended consequences in this regard. That is the end of the general part. Can you stop for questions and answers, or must I proceed, Mr. Chairman?
Honourable members, can we proceed?
Proceed.
Questions at the end then, or can I do have some questions?
I think I'll take questions at the end, and I
end.
You say there's a 24/7 point of contact.
What page?
He must know. Just a couple of pages back. Yeah. And you say that there's a certain amount of capacity that's available and it's adequate. Now, where is this capacity? What is this capacity?
Okay,
you want to implement it. Currently in terms of the bill, 24/7 is a structure that mainly will help to facilitate international cooperation on an expeditious basis. It will be discussed later in the further chapters precisely what the powers is that must be afforded to that structure. So first, there is current capacity since Interpol is already used to deal with international cooperation in cyber crimes. Secondly, there is certain capacity in the South African police that specifically deals with cyber crime per se. They've got some capacity.
Okay, well, can I just ask you something about clarity there, please, because otherwise I'm going to get lost in translation. What capacity is there in the South African police? Can you please elaborate on that?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Okay, regarding capacity in the South African police, currently there is cyber investigations that is carried out by the South African police. They do have forensic capacity in the police to an extent. It must be acknowledged, like I already indicated, must be bettered. But I can only take this far as to say that there is at least some capacity in the police currently to deal with cybercrime investigations. If further information is needed, it's probably necessary to obtain that from the South African police.
Thank you.
Okay, sorry, then I have one more question. Is it attached somewhere? Is it annexed? Can we have a look at it?
Mr. Chairperson, I did attach the SAYAS to the certificate that was signed off by the relevant functionary. I believe the SAYAS is available. We can furnish it to the committee at some stage if some of the members want to look at it.
Okay, fine.
Thank you, Chair. Greetings to you and the honourable members and our guests. I only took one question in the comment. The first question is, when I'm listening to you unfolding the bill, to me it sounds as if it's more about what is happening in, or what might happen in the country, the cyber crimes within the country. But I want to know the involvement of, because you also said there are many stakeholders involved in drafting the bill. I want to know the involvement and submissions of the defense intelligence of the SNDF, because also there is also cyber crimes between states. And I don't hear that, because we know in most cases that especially these days, the war itself can be declared through cyber crime, cyber security. I mean, someone can press a button in the boardroom and it means that it's somewhere. So one wants to get the, whether that's aspects of the national security in terms of international relations is covered. But lastly, when you speak of the capacity in the SAPS, I believe that the cyber security or cyber crimes, it's one of the new kind of crimes, although they've been there, but it needs a special investigation and special skills. So I want to know whether if you speak of the SAPS, I hear you spoke about forensic, are you not referring to the crime intelligence unit of the SAPS? Because I think those are the much relevant unit to deal with this kind of crimes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. Regarding the South African National Defence Force and the involvement in the cyber initiative of South Africa, in terms of the law in clause 53, there's a reference to the fact that National Defence Force must get the necessary capacity to fulfil the constitutional mandate in order to defend the Republic of South Africa. In terms of the National Cybercrime Policy Framework that was rolled out, which is the policy document that will prescribe what different departments must do, there is specific obligations on the South African National Defence Force to come to terms with cyber warfare and also for them to obtain and develop the necessary capacity to defend the Republic in cyberspace. That is in line with what is currently taking place within other countries throughout the world. They even got cyber warfare policies and cyber defense policies. That is catered for in the overall implementation of the South African Cyber Security Initiative. Regarding the investigation of criminal offences, where reference was made by the honourable member to the fact that crime intelligence may be the more suitable division in the South African police to investigate cybercrime, it's our submission that it is actually left to the South African police how they want to investigate cybercrime. They can appoint members at will, as long as they do investigate cybercrime. I don't think we can choose where it comes from. I must again reiterate, in order to address current capacity in investigation of cybercrime, the bill do provide that private persons can be appointed as investigators to assist the South African police. That clause is in most cyber laws of other countries. Everybody acknowledges that one department cannot fully come to terms with the knowledge to investigate all kinds of cyber crime. You need to involve private persons.
On that one of involving private persons to investigate cybercrime. Well, I don't know whether the bill states it, but I'll be very worried if the bill does not state that kind of a private person must have the security check done. Because some of these things, one cannot have an ordinary person, maybe from outside the country, saying I've got skills, I can do that. But in the process, leak the very same critical information you are supposed to investigate outside. I mean, if the bill is not silent on the issue of private investigators getting the security clearance, I'll be disappointed, Chair, for the national security of the state.
I will, Mr. Jefferson. Look, what happens in other countries is that a suitably qualified person is appointed, and there's usually certain restrictions on what he can do, what he can access, and what he can divulge. Similarly, the police will use the same modus operandi if they appoint persons here. I think it's inherent in cyber forensics that there is confidentiality attached to an investigation. One must also take into account that in terms of clause 24 of the bill, standard operating procedures may be issued in order to further regulate the investigation of crime. Part of standard operating procedures internationally is that confidentiality needs to be addressed. So that will be catered in the standard operating procedures or by means of internal policies.
Thank you, Honorable Mulan and Honorable Mulan.
Yes, I just want to make a follow-up. I'm a bit worried. These private people, I don't say quite a sensitive thing. These private people, you said there's a provision for that in the bill. And why? Because, I mean, if the police don't have that particular capacity to do so, why can't they train police to do so? Why should we have in the bill provisions that you can take a person other than the police? Because, for example, if the police need somebody who is trained for argument's sake as a forensic expert or medical, you don't need to put it in the bill that you can use a particular person. And that's the first question I wanted to answer. Secondly, you are talking about where you talked about you're saying you're consolidating this bill, there is existing bills that are made, or you've got new chapters that you have introduced, or you're consolidating what is already there. If so, what countries has this country, and if you can say briefly that there is an agreement of cooperation with various countries already. And if so, which country are you talking
about? Thanks, Chairperson. I just have two clarity seeking questions here. At page 8, the MTN commented about the constitutional rights and also the FOPIA. So I wanted to know the test you made so that this bill is not challengeable in terms of those two main acts, the FOPIA and the Constitution. And at page 14, the Legal Aid South Africa also commented about the state involvement in terms of monitoring. And in your response, you said there is no monitoring can take place for state to monitor business activities. So who will be monitoring this thing if you are divorcing the state, the government, from monitoring these cyber activities, be business or private?
Okay, regarding private persons that is appointed to assist the South African police, I must remember they are not the persons that have the primary obligation to investigate. The bill merely provides that the police must investigate cybercrime, but that they may be assisted by persons that have the necessary expertise. The problem in cybercrime, per se, is that cybercrime evolves so quickly. It's impossible for a single person who is not an expert to keep abreast of cybercrime. The techniques that's used today is outdated by tomorrow, and so on and so on. So it's impossible for the government to train persons in all aspects to deal with cybercrime and cyber forensics. So first, the police is the responsible party that investigates the cybercrime. Secondly, the bill merely provides that they may be assisted by persons that investigate cybercrime. You raise a concern that why is it necessary to put this in a bill? One can look at the recent judgments by the Supreme Court of Appeal that stated that if a warrant is issued, the warrant must specifically stipulate that only specific persons mentioned in that warrant must participate in the search and seizure. The bill gives a fig there too and says, okay, we do give you the necessary powers to use investigators, but it's subject to your control. In any case, if you're going to use an investigator, it must be authorized in terms of a search warrant. So there is, it is necessary to recognize the use of that investigator's involved.
Is it not generally accepted that anybody can be requested by police at a particular time to assist them in their investigation? Why must it be in the bill? That's the problem I'm having.
Wilma, I did refer to the recent constitutional Supreme Court of Appeal judgment. I think it was the Congwana judgment. Yeah, that relates to the persons that might be, must or can assist or be on a certain premises to investigate. The person must be mentioned. It is correct that in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, there is a provision that South African police may request the person to assist him in an investigation. But one must remember, this is kind of different than real-world investigations. In terms of the bill, there was a need to indicate what is an investigator. Namely, it's a person that has got the necessary expertise to assist the South African police in the investigation. So it must be a qualified person.
Mr. Chair, I've got some fears as Honorable Mpumlwana on the issue of, I understand the criminal procedure that police can summon, but for all this particular kind of the crime, to have the clause in the bill that the SAPS can appoint someone whether qualified global to assist. My problem, Chair, that I see, we might have a situation whereby our police never reach a special skill to investigate, because we might end up outsourcing this kind of a work to those independent experts if we have this kind to say everyone must come and assist. When will we have these people of our own getting trained, having necessary capacity to investigate this kind of crime rather than outsourcing? Because we can put it like this, but in practice it will end up being the outsourced kind of a job. That is where my worry is. And we have this kind of qualified investigators who are operating in this country, even security companies, but who are foreignly owned. I mean, we can have that kind of an agreement that there must be confidentiality. But once that person goes back to his country, you'll not have an influence or a control over that person. And as far as I see it, Chair, it's a kind of a critical kind of type of investigation. That does not need to be given to any person, but particularly SAPS. And that is why I'm saying if there's a need to train and equip our people, let's do that rather than outsourcing and putting in the bill that whoever can assist, as long as it's qualified. So it's just an example. I'm sorry if I will offend anyone. There is one private investigator who really destabilizes SAPS sometimes. He's always investigating every command of SAPS who's there, and he's got more than 5 passports. And that thing in its own is a threat to the security of the country. You can't control that person. Whenever that person feels that he doesn't like so and so and is a head of police, there'll be something that will be doing privately. So I'm just trying to guard against those things. That's my worry, Chair.
I think we are the lawmakers. Then if we are not happy with an approach, we must make a proposal here as lawmakers. Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we must...
I'm
sorry, yes, it's connected to the Honourable Harvey. We must be a little careful to just say that we don't want to make use of outside assistance for the police in these particular matters, because from experience, there can be many matters that need investigation at one time. And it takes a lot of human resources to investigate. And the police cyber unit is historically not very large. And at one time you may need 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 people per site. And if you can't do each site simultaneously, then it has its own negative effect. So I think if we want to tighten up on who the investigators can be, that's fine. But to exclude that possibility, I think, will damage the ability of the police to effectively investigate cybercrime.
The question is not that the police cannot be assisted by anybody. The question is, why must be inserted? It is not covered by Criminal Procedure Act. Why must this particular bill, because there are quite a number of bills that assist the police, why must this particular one be an exception? Because I'm saying that in other, why is it not really covered? I just want to say, is it really not covered by Criminal Procedure Act provisions? Must we add on this particular one? Is it absolutely necessary? I understand the questions on the warrant, but that doesn't mean that you can't use that Criminal Procedure Act in the warrant. Why must we have it here in the bill? That was my main question.
Chair, I think it's a very important issue that has been raised, and I propose that we flag it because there's some very critical policy issues in relation to private persons being involved in investigations and security of information, etc., and also very importantly, capacity building within the police, because if you have a provision that says you may outsource the investigation, then you may never build the capacity within. So I think we should flag the issue. And as we develop the bill further, proposals may come from the committee, but we should also bring a further proposal and how we deal with it after meeting with SAPS and doing further research, especially on the questions raised by Honourable Member Paul Wallace.
Okay, thank you very much. Honourable McClaffin.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I've got 2 comments here or questions. The first one is the issue raised by regarding that the concern raised by Mr. Hale, whereby he said there should be two separate legislation in terms of cyber crime and cyber security. So don't you think it will be proper to, maybe in definition, to clearly define the cyber crime and cyber security in order to try to address this confusion? Then the second one is in terms of benchmarking. I can see in most cases reference is made to international documents. I've seen here, yes, on page 29 you made mention of African Union Convention, the Budapest Convention. Is there no any other country regionally or continentally which may also, you know, give us light on the same issue? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have just one issue. Legal aid South Africa raises a concern that the bill threatens digital rights and it also lacks important checks and balances. And in response, the department does not deny that the bill threatens digital rights. It says here that the rights are not infringed in an unconstitutional manner, meaning that there is an element of infringement, but not in an unconstitutional manner. Now, it also, the response also says there are necessary checks and balances. Legal Aid South Africa is not here to argue their case. And it's their weight against yours. Can I be convinced that there are really checks and balances? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm just interested on your response to South African Communications Forum, the response that relates to the bill having limited costs. What is limited costs implications? I'm sorry, it just gives us an idea of what will be required monetarily. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Regarding the cost implication of the bill, so far as it relates to the cyber crime part of the bill, it's our submission that there is no real cost implications on any businesses that will actually affect them. Firstly, if you look at the procedures to investigate cyber crime, the only real cost implications that can result from such an investigation is, amongst others, certain orders for preservation of data to area that, let's say, a communication service provider or a person must for a certain period store certain information. That may have some cost implications, but really it's not much. Other than that, it is admitted that there is no real cost implication. Now then, one must remember that most electronic communication service providers are currently RICO compliant. They've got extensive obligations to already deal with aspects regarding storing of data and other obligations. So, if it's a service provider that's involved, the provisions of the bill will not in any stretch, or cannot impose additional cost implications. That is my submission. But on the other hand, if you look at cybersecurity, that is the critical information infrastructure part of the bill. If a person is declared a critical information infrastructure, there need to be put in place certain security measures to protect data and networks against infringement. That may have cost implications for that infrastructure. I do address it comprehensively under Chapter 11, but my submission is that most of the big service providers already implement the necessary measures to ensure that their systems and data are secured. If additional measures is imposed on them, it will be in line with international standards. And it's my submission that we need to come to grips with cybersecurity in South Africa. And if a system is underprotected, it's actually the country, the people that is suffering. And cost implications that may result from that is therefore authorized or in public interest. Regarding Legal Aid South Africa, we made a remark that firstly, the bill affects digital rights adversely, and secondly, that it lacks important checks and balances. To respond thereto, it is done later in the bill where I do deal inter alia with harmful communications. I think there's a five-page discussion of the extent to which infringement is authorized under a constitutional dispensation. I will discuss it in depth there, but currently what I can say is the cyber crimes in Chapter 2, it's my submission that it does to an extent infringe privacy or digital rights, but it's a necessity to criminalize that type of conduct. Regarding malicious communications, same argument can be made that it is necessary to address digital communications or criminalize certain reprehensible conduct in cyberspace. Although it's an infringement, it's a lawful infringement under the Constitution. It's like all crimes in South Africa, a crime is there to protect people so that their rights are not adversely affected. So I can go further on, and I do discuss it in more detail when I deal with search and seizures. The constitutional issues that relate to search and seizures and how it is addressed in the bill. First, in terms of the bill chapter 5, judicial authorization is usually always a requirement before a search and seizure can take place. Secondly, if any data or information is accessed, it must be done under judicial authorization. And the whole chapter 5 followed the same trend to say, yes, infringement may be necessary to investigate crimes, but judicial authorization is required. It works on the same basis as the investigation of ordinary crimes in the real world. There is necessary checks and balances, which I will discuss in detail. Regarding the constitutional rights issue in Popia that was raised by MTN, I think what MTN envisaged here is that on the one hand, you get a Protection of Personal Information Act that aims to protect the privacy of personal information. And on the other hand, you get a criminal system that actually authorized that certain personal information must be made available to the state in order to investigate crimes. My submission that the public interest overrides POPIA in that regard. And I did say that the right to privacy is not a right that cannot be limited by other rights.
Okay. Fine.
should also accept that this is a complex bill that may require inputs by other departments, and that we can't expect all the answers. The important thing is that the critical questions are raised and that they are followed up until we all reach satisfaction.
Can we proceed?
Chair, to answer the question of Honourable Member Tapo about the benchmarking, and we mentioned the AU Convention, we mentioned the Budapest Convention, and whether there's a regional convention. South Africa has signed the AU Convention, but I believe it has not ratified it. It has not signed it. There's currently moves to have a global convention, which is what I believe the Department of International Relations is supporting as well. But there is no regional convention at this point in time. Those are the two conventions that some countries have signed, the AU Convention and the Budapest Convention. The Budapest Convention, as you know, is a convention that arises from Europe. Then the other question was, should we not define cybercrime and cybersecurity? And what do we say about Mr. Hank's proposal that there be two separate bills? We take the view that cybercrime and cybersecurity are so closely linked to each other that they ought to be in one single bill, and we don't see any conflict with being in one bill. So that is why we deal with it currently in that fashion, and in fact I think internationally there's also a precedent for it to be dealt with in that fashion.
Follow up on cybercrime and cybersecurity. What I wanted is maybe in their definition, they clearly distinguish between the two for us to or the outside to understand it very clearly.
Mr. Chairperson, I will try to clarify. First, if you look at cybersecurity, I think in academic language, cybersecurity encompasses everything that is necessary to ensure that systems and users of communication systems are secure against unauthorized interference. So that is the one thing, that is the general overarching cybersecurity notion. Part of cybersecurity is cybercrime. Crimes that is committed by way of a computer. So it's actually a subpart of cybersecurity. It's very difficult to get a comprehensive definition that clearly differentiate between cybercrimes on the one hand and cybersecurity on the other hand. I will actually say it's almost impossible.
Now that I'm actually asked, I don't know, is there any way where it covers interception of information and how it's dealt with? Because I was actually trying to look at that and how we criminalize that. Do we criminalize it?
Chairperson, regarding the interception of communication, there is provision in the bill, clause 38, that provides that if interception of communication needs to take place, it must take place in terms of the RICO. You cannot use the procedures that are stipulated in Chapter 5 of the Act to obtain indirect communications, communication-related information on an ongoing basis. If you do that, you will contravene RICO. Section 38 therefore clearly say use RICA to intercept communications and nothing else. In terms of the RICA, there's various serious offences. I think the criminalising provision is section 45 of the RICA, and the penalties is prescribed under section 55 of the RICA. That they say if somebody without judicial authorization intercept any communication, he or she commits an offence and is liable. I think punishment varies from 10 years upwards, and the fines are in the millions. So it is criminalised, but not in terms of the bill. It's outside the bill. It's by way of other.
Just in addition to the question about the interception, we deal with it quite extensively in the rest of the documents, because there is that interplay between interception of communications and this bill. So we do deal with it further as well.
Maybe just a follow-up, Chairperson, to say, how do you then deal with it here? Because you're actually saying it's catered for in RICA, but you do deal with it as well here. And now here with cybercrime, how do you then deal with it?
Chairperson, what we said in the comments is that when we responded is that the purpose of this bill is not to regulate interception. It's dealt with primarily in RICA. So that's how we've dealt with it.
I think let's leave it there, because we don't want to incorporate the RICA provision.
I just wanted to clarify to what extent you've looked at the critical infrastructure bill, and no, that's just really my question. And should we? And how does it impact on our bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Currently, there is a bill that was drafted by the South African Police Services, the Critical Infrastructure Bill, that has been introduced in Parliament. On the one hand, this bill also deals with the protection of infrastructure, but only information infrastructure. We did look at that bill, and we did consult with the drafters of that bill, and were to an extent also involved in the drafting of that bill. And there is a clear differentiation between the Critical Infrastructure Bill and this bill that deals with the protection of critical information infrastructure. Our bill before the committee aims to secure systems and data, or mainly communication systems. On the other hand, the infrastructure bill deals with physical objects, amongst others buildings and places and installations. And there is a clause in the infrastructure bill that is included that do stipulate that where the South African Police wants to declare a critical infrastructure, and it contains aspects that should be dealt with in terms of this bill, that there should be consultation between the relevant ministers, and the decision needs then to be made under which bill that needs to be addressed.
Thank you. I think we should now move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I'm going to deal with the definitions. There were comments relating on the definitions in the bill. It's chapter 1, and that's on page 33 of the comments. First one relates to the definition of access. The definition of access here is in relation to chapter 5, which prescribes one of the powers of the police to access an article that needs to be investigated, and the concern is raised with the broad wording, especially the phrase without limitation that is included in that section, or that definition rather, and our submission is that white powers is necessary and needs to be set out in legislation that empowers the investigation of cybercrime. And our submission that we cannot change that. However, there is a proposed amendment that the department wants to affect to this definition. I'm not going to discuss this here at this stage. We can do that at a later stage when the bill is revised. Then on page 34, it's paragraph 2.2, article. There's a concern regarding the use of the word article in the definition of an article. That is usually not acceptable drafting style, but it has been done in the past. We acknowledge that and we do propose linguistic correction. On page 35, there's a concern raised by Legal Aid South Africa that relates to the definition of article involved in an offence, and they refer to two paragraphs of that definition where there is a reasonable suspicion requirement, and then refer to other paragraph of that definition that only requires that if articles involved or can reasonably expect it to be used as evidence that they can seize it. And the concern is then raised that this is unjustifiable. It must be pointed out that the bill try to stay as close as possible to the current Criminal Procedure Act in the investigation of cybercrime, and that the same wording that is contained in section 20B of the Criminal Procedure Act was used in drafting that specific provision. MTN has a concern that the article refers to data computer, computer program, data storage medium, computer systems, and according to them that is not in line with the international benchmarks. It's our submission that it is in line with international benchmarks, and that that five categories of objects that is stipulated in that definition is the essentials against which a cybercrime is committed or which is used to commit a cybercrime. Then on page 36, a similar concern is raised. I'm not going to deal with that. On page 37, that's paragraph 2.2.5, the South African Human Rights Commission raised some concerns regarding the definition of article in this regard. That mainly relates to the fact that privacy can be infringed, and we did discuss it there, and we pointed out that obviously on the first hand judicial authority is always necessary before privacy can be infringed or any other right in terms of the bill. And we referred to various recent judgments by the courts regarding search and procedure provisions. And we also indicate that search and seizure is in line with the provisions of the Criminal Procedure Act, and there's additional safeguards to deal with possible infringement of privacy. I think the bill to cater or address unconstitutional infringement sufficiently. On page 38, we deal with the definition of computer, and the service providers raised the concern that computers is no longer a computer that we know, and they ask the question whether the definition is wide enough to cater for other devices or programs which simulate the functions of a computer. And our submission is that the definition is wide enough and do cater for new technologies as well as virtualization of computer functions. That's on page 38. On page 39, the concern paragraph B is basically the same. I'm not going to go into depth in that. Page 39, they, at paragraph C, they raised the concern that the definitions should be wide enough to cater for smartphones, tablets, which must be considered as computers, and it's our submission that the definition of computer is wide enough and per se includes all programmable devices in that definition, and that that should be considered as a computer. On page 40, a similar concern is raised by Deloitte regarding the fact that new inventions or technologies might not be included in terms of the definition of a computer. Our submission is that it is included in the definition. The department, however, wants to propose amendment to this definition, and it's set out on page 40 to 41. On page 41, there is a concern by NTN that the definition of computer currently includes devices that is not per se a computer device. My response there too is that in some instances computer devices and the peripheral of which they include are extremely closely associated. And during a consultation process on the bill, a lot of people did request us to expand on that definition. However, our submission that if we amend the position or the definition as is proposed on page 40 to 41, that it will be adequate to deal with this close case scenario of various devices, and it's not necessary to refer to various peripherals. Okay, on page 41, there's also a page regarding the definition of computer storage device that is dealt with in paragraph 24. And the concern is raised that we include in our definition of computer storage device allocation. If one look at the international benchmark for this definition, firstly it varies from country to country, but the general recognizable definition is that it must be a medium on which data is stored. However, in the discussion I do refer to the fact that cloud computing per se influenced the definition of a computer system. Cloud computing is usually where there's various servers available that distributes information and plays a cloud of information available to persons that can access it, and it's our submission that location need to be included in that definition. On page 42, there's a new proposed definition that was suggested by Banking Association South Africa, and that's electronic communications identity number. We agree that this definition should be inserted. It was oversight during the drafting. And we do propose a definition on clause 42 at the bottom to 43. On page 43, definition of electronic communication service provider. Paul Rice gave extensive comment on malicious communications, and they requested that persons that render a social media service should be included under the definition of electronic communication service provider, and that the current definition only restricts that to electronic communication service providers to which license has been issued. Our submission is that it's not necessary to expand on that definition of electronic communication service provider, since chapter 3 and the clauses that deals with malicious communications actually do expand it further to include persons that render blogging services, etc. Going to page 44, definition of financial institution, that's paragraph 2.7. The Minister of Finance requests that this the definition of financial institution be amended as a result of the Financial Sector Regulation Act that was recently enacted. We agree with that and we propose a definition on page 44. Further on page 44, there's a proposal of a new definition of National Strategic Intelligence Act. There's references is made in the bill to that act, but it is not taken up in the definitions part, so we do agree with that amendment, and we did propose an amendment on page 45. On page 45, paragraph 2.9, a concern is raised about output of data, which is defined. Output of data is defined in relation to the offence in clause 2 of the bill that deals with unlawful securing access. And according to MTN, the definition is not comprehensive enough. And we do give an explanation thereof, amongst others, that it was based on foreign legislation, and that output of data in this context don't need to be defined any further, since it relates to, amongst others, in any other manner how data is displayed or can be obtained, amongst others, to view it on a computer screen, to print it out, to intercept the electronic emissions from a screen. It does mention that the definition need not be amended. Page 45, paragraph 2.10, Banking Association South Africa requested that the word person need to be expanded upon to include the state. It's our submission that this is not necessary. On page 46, paragraph 2.11, the word public available data is apparently wrong. It should read publicly available data, and we do agree with that amendment. Similar contextual amendment is proposed to the definition of fees, paragraph 2.12. There's a concern about traffic data by MTN, which states it's broadly defined, not in line with international best practices. Our submission is that it is in line with international best practices, as pointed out on page 46 to 47. In general, there was the concern that we do not define cybercrime in the bill. Our response thereto is that there is no general accepted definition of cybercrime. And if we do insert a definition of cybercrime, it might lead to interpretational problems. And that more or less end the discussion of the definition. I'm going to continue.
Connecting on definitions, can we continue? I think definitions are different. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Going to deal with the actual body of the bill now, and that is cyber crimes. I'm on page 48, and it's chapter 3, and it's paragraph 2.1. Chapter 2. The first concern is that we do not recognize the use of digital tracking and analytical software that is used for commercial purposes, and a concern is raised that this may be criminalized in terms of the bill. Our submission is that the bill does not criminalize the use of this analytical software. However, analytical software can be used outside the aim and purposes for which they are used, and if they do contravene the provisions of the Act, it will amount to a cyber crime. There's a very important comment that was raised by the South African Communications Forum at page 48. They say the bill has a shortcoming that it does not deal with identity theft on the one hand, as well as the offence of phishing. Phishing is more or less where you receive an email from the South African Revenue Services that tells you you get a payback of $1 million, they just need your credit card number. And it's our submission, it's not necessary to criminalize phishing in terms of the bill. There's other offences in the bill, amongst others forgery and uttering and computer-related fraud that adequately deal with phishing. Identity theft is a problem. It was in the bill that was originally developed. The service providers also raised that concern. That is probably an aspect that needs to be addressed in terms of this bill. I believe there was a recent scare that personal information of between 33 million and 66 million in South Africa were made available to everybody else. So that's possible. A possible thing that needs to be included in the bill. On page 49, there's again a concern about POPI. It's our submission that POPI is not relevant in criminal investigations. POPI cannot adequately address the crimes. That is in chapter 2 of the bill. So, page 49, further on, at paragraph 315, there's again the comments by the service providers that we should probably deal with offences relating to personal and financial information. Currently, in terms of the POPI, the mere acquiring of personal information may be an administrative offence if you are a person that is under obligation to deal with personal information, but a hacker is obviously not subject to the POPIA, and there's nothing that criminalizes conduct in cyberspace except section 105 and maybe 106, but that relates to account numbers and not the other personal information that may be involved. Going to skip further to page 51, at paragraph 316. What the service providers propose here is that a clause be inserted in the bill that provides that they are not criminal liable for offences that is committed on the system. It's our submission that on the reading of the bill, it's not necessary to include such a clause in the bill. So we do not agree with that. Page 52, the comments by by Michelson's attorneys regarding unlawfulness. According to them, unlawfulness is wrongly used in the bill. And according to them, it's tautology to refer to unlawfulness in a prescription that he seems itself is unlawful. The person probably don't understand unlawfulness. Unlawfulness means, in short, not going to deal with all the elements of criminal liability that's summarized in page 52 and further on, but unlawfulness in South African law has got, first, if you don't include it in the bill, it will be read in by the court. I can refer you to State versus Celebi, a Supreme Court of Appeal decision, where this is more or less summarized. A Unlawfulness does not mean criminalization or a proscription in an act. Unlawfulness means that there is the absence of any possible grounds of justification which can justify the act. It also plays an important role regarding intention. Where offence is committed, one must appreciate a wrongfulness or unlawfulness of its act. So our submission is that his perspective of criminal liability is incorrect. Let's skip to page 54. And the concern is raised about the broadness of the offences. And he referred to clauses 2, 3, 5 and 7 of the Act. And according to him, certain elements of the offences has got a similarity. It's our submission that the offences are clearly defined, substantially in line with legislation of almost all countries in the world, and it's admitted that offences is not vague or overly broad. I must, however, point out it's very essential for cyber legislation to be in line with international benchmarks. That will facilitate interpretation of the cyber bill in South Africa, and it will also facilitate international cooperation. On page 55, the concern is raised by, or rather, a suggestion is made by Ms. Zulfa Khan regarding biometric images as a security tool, and she wants to know if it's criminalized, and our response is yes, it is criminalized in terms of clause 7, 1 and 2 of the bill. It deals with password and related matters, offences. Page 55, there's a concern how we deal with the intention element in the bill. It refers to clauses 2 to 7 of the bill, where the prescription is more or less to the following effect. Any person who unlawfully and intentionally do something commits an offence. It then refers to clauses 8 to 10. That deals, amongst others, with cyber fraud and forgery and uttering. When we say any person who unlawfully and with the intention to defraud do a certain conduct, that person is guilty of an offence. And he said that the latter approach is preferable. Our submission is that it's not necessary. Even if we deal with something like ordinary fraud, there's always kind of double intention, to the effect that you must have intention to commit an offence, and the other intention is obviously your objective was to defraud somebody. My submission is it's not necessary to include such a double intention element in that two clauses, and we are fine with the manner in which the bill is drafted. On page 56, concern is again raised in paragraph 3.11 about other cyber criminal conduct in the statute book. I did explain that we did repeal all other laws that currently criminalize conduct in cyberspace. On page 56, paragraph 3.1.12, concern is raised that there is no public interest defence under the bill. This is specifically raised in terms of clauses 2 and 3 of the bill. This unlawful access is the offence in clause 2, and clause 3 is overcoming security measures and to obtain data unlawfully. And he then refers to the fact that journalists may be held accountable for obtaining information illegally. And in our discussion, opposite the HM, paragraph 3.12, we do refer to the various cases in South Africa that deals with journalists, and the extent to entitlement to information. I think the crux of all this judgments is to the effect that a journalist is not entitled to special protection. We cannot provide for special protection of journalists. Regarding a public interest defense, look, that is something that we cannot deal with in the bill. It can probably be dealt with outside the bill if the legislature want to, by way of general legislation relating to criminal liability, to recognize that defense. But our submission, it's unlikely to happen due to the fact that various circumstances need to be taken into account. One must remember that the current offences in the criminal law was developed by our High Court over a long period of time, and that such a public interest defence is in general problematic, and it cannot. The bottom line is we cannot deal with that in the bill. I'm going to skip further to page 58 and paragraph 3.2, and that deals with the offence of unlawful access. Telkom, Vodacom and Celsi recognize the offence is basically in line with international precedent, but they did suggest in the committee dealing public submissions that the offence should probably be amended to be in line with the Budapest Convention. And we did draft the amendment to give effect to those suggestions, which is contained in page 58 to 59. We're not going to make suggestions which one is preferable over the other one. On page 59, Deloitte deals with the element of negligence that's not addressed in the bill, and they want to ensure that negligent access should be criminalised. My submission is that the bill only aims to criminalise intentional conduct. Negligence as appropriate form of intent is rarely criminalised in criminal law in South Africa. I can probably think of culpable homicide and contravention and certain other statutory provisions as the limited offences to which it applies. But for general purposes, it's our submission that direct intent should be applicable here. On page 59, there's concern by the South African Human Rights Commission on page on paragraph 323 that the use of the word intentionally may have certain adverse consequences on whistleblowers and journalists. And our response thereto is that journalists is in general not entitled to protection, and whistleblowers is protected to the extent provided for in the Protected Disclosures Act. So we're not going to consider a specific exclusion of any regard relating to that offence. Page 60, Internet Solutions. They referred again to the broadness of the offence, but then they remark that the word securing, as is used in clause 2, may be interpreted to mean to safeguard or to protect, and that the clause is therefore drafted too broad or incoherently or nonsensical. My submission is that the word securing cannot be interpreted to include the act of making safe or to protect the computer system. Securing means here the time when you have control of or access or where you can do something relating to data, computer, or computer system. And in any event, the offence in that clause too is based on the UK Computer Misuse Act. And on page 16, paragraph 3 to 4b, there's a remark that clause 2 lack essential criminal elements to make it an offence. And our submission is that it is not, and that commentator therefore overlooked one of the essential ingredients of cybercrime, namely unauthorized access. It's only criminalized if it's unauthorized. If it's authorized, it can never be criminalized. Page 61, paragraph C. The remark is made that the clause should ensure that harm or damage is committed. According to him, the current clause doesn't refer to that. Our submission is that the harm that is committed is the mere accessing of the computer system, similar to housebreaking. And if there's no authorization, the harm is in the fact that you actually access a house without authorization. He also referred to the fact that other legislation do require that access should be temporary or permanently. Our submission is that it's not necessary to specify that two elements. The mere access is the offence. That's it. In C3, it's recommended that a clause be deleted since access is criminalized under other clauses. Our submission is no, cannot be deleted. The offenses in clauses 3, 4, 5, and 6 deal with other aspects of cybercrime. Clause 2 is the gating offense, the first essential offense that must be criminalized. On page 62, paragraph 3 to 6, MNET has raised the concern that the bill does not define what constitutes unlawfulness. Various other persons have raised that. And our submission is we cannot define unlawfulness. Unlawfulness in a South African law has been worked out over a period of time, and the court has recognized that there is no limited grounds available in South African law which will make an unlawful conduct lawfully. So in general, there is no limited amount of defenses which may exclude unlawfulness. So our submission is that it is possible to define that in the bill. Further, in paragraph B, they refer to, again, software relating to market purposes and other software that may be used, amongst others, to investigate cybercrime. And they raise a concern that unlawful access of data and other offences should be linked to a specific intention to commit a serious offence. Our submission is that it's not necessary to link that to a serious offence. They did refer to the Australian Cyber Crimes Act, which is actually currently included in the Criminal Code, and even the Australian legislation do make provision for a serious offence of access as well as a lesser offence of access. So we are fine with that comment. I'm not going to discuss paragraph 3.2.7. It relates again to the poppies operation vis-à-vis the bill. It must be indicated that that person referred to a wrong version of the bill. Freedom of Religion responded that clause 2 may have unintended consequences for ordinary internet users who through ignorance mishandled other people's data. Our submission is that ordinary internet users have access to publicly available data, and that access is only prohibited in terms of clause 2 when this is done to non-public available data. And in any event, the offence of access is usually committed by technical means, meaning that certain software or hardware is used to overcome protection measures. And furthermore, the concern of ignorance, it must be pointed out that the intent requirement in terms of the bill is direct intention. Negligence is not criminalized. I run through to the end of the offences.
I'm sorry, yes, if it's just 5 minutes, you can continue.
Okay, there was a concern by freedom of religion that clause 2 may have unintended consequences for ordinary internet users through ignorance access or mishandle other people's data. Our submission is that ordinary internet users usually have access to publicly available data. To commit the offence of access, there must firstly be a direct intention to commit the offence. To commit the offence of access, technical means are usually used to commit the offence, and the ordinary internet user will usually not use that means to commit the offence. And according to us, it will not criminalise negligent conduct or conduct by mere ordinary internet users.
Okay, we can have just 5 minutes or 3 minutes break because we are only left with 30 minutes to finish the business of the day. So if we can just quickly go.
Okay,
all right. We're not going to have a break, but members and everybody's actually just allowed to go in and out. There's also tea outside, so that we can be in the position to productively use the remaining 30 minutes.
I think Mr. Roberts wants a break.
You may proceed.
We don't want to talk to
her. I think Mr. Roberts, the chairperson, if I may continue. He was on page 63, clause 3.3.1. There was a comment that was made by the by Selfie, Telcom and Vodacom. It says that clause 3.1, the offence must be brought in line with the international position that criminalises interception of communications from or within a computer system. And although the current clause addresses the aspect, similar wording used by other legal systems and international instruments will facilitate international cooperation and assist in the interpretation of the bill. You will see in our response that we agree with the proposal, and when we get to the clause-by-clause deliberation on the bill, we will propose an amendment in that regard. So we deal with that on page 64, but I'm not going to go into that detail. I'm going to deal with page 65. It talks about the bill does not define a satisfactory exculpatory account of possession and may lead to undue arrest until the court interprets the expression. In this regard, we are saying that the offences of possession of data where there is suspicion that it was acquired unlawfully and a subsequent failure to give an exculpatory account, which means an account that will exonerate or tend to exonerate the accused of the guilt, meaning that you must give an explanation that shows that you are not guilty, will be interpreted in accordance with the legal precedents that were developed around the interpretation of Section 36 of the General Law Amendment Act, and that creates a similar offense. In terms of a case, Osman versus another, this is actually a Constitution Court case. The constitutionality of Section 36 was considered, and according to the court, Section 36 does not compel the suspect to do anything, nor did it constitute pressure being applied on such a person to make a statement. I think we go further to explain what that means, and we're saying that our clause in the bill is fashioned on Section 36 of the General Law Amendment Act, and it has been found to be constitutional. If I may move on to page 66. A comment from Michelson's attorneys. The Constitutional Court stated that not all statutory provisions that create a reverse onus are unconstitutional because they unjustifiably infringe on the presumption of innocence. The court weighed up the factors relating to the societal need for the successful prosecution of crime. The concern with reverse onuses is not whether the accused must prove or disprove an element, but rather that the reverse onus creates a situation where the accused could be convicted where reasonable doubt exists. I think Mr. Roberts has dealt with the fact that there is no reverse onus regarding Clause 3.3. And I must add, Chairperson, that during the extensive consultation process on this bill and the team of experts that were set up, we dealt with this issue of a reverse onus. And we have the view that we have dealt with it sufficiently in the bill, that we do not create any reverse onus in the bill. Further on, Clause 67, page 67, Clause... the Human Rights Commission also spoke about the unable to give a satisfactory exculpatory account, and it's a concern to them. The concern is raised that the offence may involve an element of subjectivity in evaluating whether the account is satisfactory. I have spoken about why we need not define it. In fact, we refer to the case law that exists in this regard already. There are other issues that have been raised about the reverse onus. Internet Solutions on page 67 talks about subsection 3.2 and 3 criminalizes anyone who knowingly, unlawfully, and intentionally possesses data which was acquired unlawfully. Internet Solutions notes that it is imperative that the government takes necessary measures to protect sensitive information stored in computer systems, considering the value of sensitive information. However, they submit the manner in which this clause is drafted fails to provide for public interest defenses. It is further submitted that it restricts the right to access to information, since not all information that is published is acquired. We have dealt with the issue of journalists in paragraph 3.1.12 regarding the submission that deals with the public interest defense and far as it relates to journalists. I'm not going to repeat that here, but we can deal with it further if it's required, when we deal with the deliberation on the bill itself, clause by clause deliberation. Page 68, again comments from service providers. The offence criminalizes the tools which are used to commit cybercrime. It is noted, it is recommended that training be given to law enforcement to ensure that they are cognizant of the fact that this clause can only be contravened when a specific intent, namely the use of the tools and the intention to commit the crime, need to be present. We have taken note of that submission. Shall I continue?
To offence that is being committed. So you can, the tools is only
your comment.
respond. The concern was they have a concern about the broadness of the criminalization regarding the use of the tool for IT security specialists in their daily work. And our submission is that the tools is only criminalized if it's used for unlawful purposes. Otherwise, it could end up an offense. On page 69, Mr. Itwell do refer to the fact that the state must prove that a tool must be used for unlawful purposes. Our response thereto is that this clause specifically ensures that the tools is only criminalized if it's used to commit a cyber offense. Paragraph 343, they indicate that they are against the criminalization of these tools, and they do refer to the fact that it should probably be better if we only criminalize the tools during the commission of an offense. So in general, what is proposed that the tool should be there, but once it is used for an offense, it should be criminalized. I think we already discussed that, but at the end of the discussion, there is a suggestion by the department that aims to give effect to this recommendation. Sorry, I think on page 69, do refer to the fact that IT specialists do need this tool in order to ensure that networks are protected against vulnerabilities. And the indication is given that this clause criminalizes various conduct relating to such tools only if it's used to commit an offense. But then the concern is again raised that this clause may criminalize the conduct of cyber experts. I think we already did for that, or responded there too. On page 70, it's the comment of MNET, paragraph 345, and their concern is that these tools may also have the effect that tools that is used for marketing purposes may be criminalized under this clause. And we did already previously respond to the comment to the effect that if the tools are not used, their tools are not used to commit an offense, it should not be criminalized. Insofar as it relates to ordinary criminalization outside the use for marketing purposes, the previous response is also applicable here. MNET raises a concern that the current focus of the bill only relates to computer networks. In terms of the ITAR legislation, there was a provision that may have aided in respect of copyright infringement. And in terms of the bill, that clause in the ITAR is being repealed and substituted with this clause of the use of tools to commit an offence. I think their concern is primarily that we undo a measure that was previously used to successfully prosecute persons that overcome security measures in respect of copyright measures. And again, our submission is this aspect should be dealt with in terms of copyright legislation and not in terms of the bill. SAFECT on page 71, paragraph 347, has concern that cookies may also be criminalized. Cookies is usually something that happens on the internet. We access a web page give an instruction to simplify to your computer and store certain information in your computer. When you access the web page, that cookie usually ensure that your experience in viewing a web page is enhanced. Our submission is that this clause will not criminalize the use of cookies. But however, if certain cookies are used to commit offences, and it can be used to commit offences, Chapter 2 of the Bill will be applicable to it. And on page 72 is the proposed amendment. We just put before the committee, and in terms of this amendment, we repeal or propose the repeal of Clause 4.1 that deals with the development, manufacturing, making available of this tool that is criminalized in terms of this clause. And in the proposed, in the next page, simply see the proposed new sub-clause 2 merely then criminalize the users or possession of the tools to commit any of the offenses. So that is probably an amicable way to deal with the development of these tools and ensure, or to restrict the ambit of that clause. On page 73, paragraph 3.5, that deals with unlawful interference of data of a computer system. Internet Solutions remarks that clause 5 should include intention to harm. Our submission that it's not necessary due to the fact that harm here is the interference with data or a computer system, and no additional harm is actually required. Clause 6 deals with the unlawful interference with data storage mediums and computer systems. On page 73, paragraph 3.6, in general, service providers do support the clause. But MTM remains the concern that this offence may criminalise interference in the ordinary course of maintenance and upgrades and testing and so forth. It's our submission that this is not a case. On page 74, paragraph 363, Internet Solutions proposed that the conduct should only be criminalised if it causes serious impairment. Our submission is that this is not necessary. There is already a principle in the South African law, the minimis non curat lex, which ensures that certain insignificant contraventions is not criminalized. That is discussed on the page 74. On page 74 to 75, paragraph 364, a concern is raised about the lack of clarity of what constitutes unlawful interference in this provision, and their concern is again in respect of system maintenance and upgrades, and I think we did already respond there too. On page 75, clause 3.7, that relates to the offence in Clause 7 of the Bill, that relates to password access codes and similar data or devices offences. Western Cape raised a technical concern about what constitutes technical concern of what constitutes password or access codes. We did give explanation, and our submission is not necessary to amend the clause to accommodate them, since it's merely a description of the type, the various types of conduct that can take place in respect of passwords, etc. On page 75, paragraph 372, a concern is raised by Telkom, Vodacom, etc. regarding the use of the word satisfactory exculpatory account of possession. this or that clause, if a person is found in possession of passwords, access codes, or certain devices that is there to protect the computer system under certain very suspicious circumstances, and the person cannot give a satisfactory account of such possession, the person can be convicted of a contravention of 472. I must explain it further, probably in this regard. Currently, there is an offence on the South African statute book. It's Section 36 of the General Law Amendment Act. In terms of that offence, when a person is found in possession of certain property under certain circumstances which must be suspicious, and if the person cannot give a satisfactory account of such possession, the person may contravene Section 37 of the General Law Amendment Act. It was extensively interpreted by the courts, and first the courts did say there's no reverse onus on the accused to prove his, or rather to disprove his guilt. Secondly, the state must prove all the elements of the offence, as well as the fact that there is no satisfactory account of such possession, and the account of such possession must obviously be substantiated by objective factors that need to be taken into account to more or less evaluate the response that was given by the accused person. So the Constitutional Court did not regard Section 36 unconstitutional, and it's our submission that the same will apply here. The offence mainly aims to address instances where the police comes to a person's house who is suspected of hacking Standard Bank or other bank or facility, and they found him in possession of a disc with 5,000 credit card numbers on the disc. Obviously, res ipsa facto, he's not the person that is entitled to that credit card numbers, and if he cannot explain that, then he committed an offence. On page 76, cyber fraud, supported. Cyber forgery and uttering. Western Cape make a comment there to the word that's used, namely passing off. Our submission is that that word is in line with the current definition of forgery and uttering in the South African law. It's explained on page 76, the B part of 391, which uses the words passing off of a false document. Okay, I'm going to skip forward. Okay, let's first deal with paragraph 310, clause 10, cyber extortion. Just want to point out that cyber extortion differs from the elements of extortion in the South African law currently, and it mainly relates to the treasure element that is required in terms of common law, which is dealt with indifferently or in other manner in terms of this criminalisation. On page 78, clause 11 deals with aggravated offences. Although the service providers do indicate that there is a need for such a criminalisation, the department do propose certain amendments to this clause. Clause 1 deals with certain offences that relates to a restricted computer system, which is currently defined as financial institutions, critical information infrastructure, and government infrastructure. Our submission is that this should rather be restricted to critical information infrastructure that is declared critical information infrastructure in terms of Chapter 11 of the bill. Furthermore, it's our submission that a specific intention is needed in the commission of this offences, namely that a person must intend to affect a critical information infrastructure. Currently, Clause 11.1 may be open to other interpretation. Again, it's faster to relate to the more serious offences where computer offences may give rise to life and limb situations. It's again the important submission that the specific intent must be included in that offence so that the person who committed the offence intended the result. Currently, again, the clause is not clear in that regard. Clause 13 deals with theft of incorporeal. Western Cape has made a remark about the use of the word incorporeal. We agree and made proposals for a possible amendment on page 79 to indicate that the adjective property of things should be added to that. On page 80, clause 14 deals with penalties in relation to the various prohibitions in that chapter. In 3.13.1 on page 80, there's a concern that the penalties might be too lenient. It's our submission that the penalties is adequate. Telkom wants us to specify a maximum penalty so that, it can act as a deterrent. That is discussed in 3.13.2. It's our submission that the clauses do prescribe maximum penalties. We do not refer to monetary fines due to the operation of the Adjustment of Fines Act, which do prescribe that if a court can impose a certain period of imprisonment, you can also impose a certain fine. So it's not necessary to repeat that in other legislation. On page 81, the service providers in clause 333 refers to the offence in clause 18 of the bill that deals with attempt, instigating, etc., or rather participation in a crime, and they say that it should attract equal punishment to those other offences that in relation to which that participation is committed. It's our submission that the clause already do provide for that. It's not necessary to insert it in clause 14. Clause 12 of the bill do provide for that. On page 82, Mr. Jamie Brandt has got a concern about teenagers that hacking. And according to him, the sentence is a bit too harsh. I must point out we did take that into account. In the schedule to the bill, there is amendments to the Child Justice Act to the effect that other sentencing options is available where persons under the age of 18 is involved in the commission of an offence. On page 83, going to skip forward to paragraph 3.13.6, where the author says hacking is dealt with in clause 2.1, and there is no need for a separate offence as contemplated in clause 11 of the bill that deals with the aggravating offences, which we want to amend. And our submission to that is that this is a specific offence that affects certain critical objectives that need that needs enhanced protection, and that is also the reason for clause 11 in the bill. In paragraph 3.13.17, certain persons referred to what's actually involved in the cybercrime. There's attorney's fees that's usually incurred by a business if certain information is unlawfully obtained from them. And the commentator referred to the various other adverse results thereof, and our submission to that remark is that the resultant damage to the scores during a cybercrime is always taken into account in the sentencing imposed for any crime by the South African courts. Page 83, paragraph 3.13.8. The South African Human Rights Commission proposed that mitigating factors should specifically be included in that clause. Our submission is that that is not necessary. Sentencing options or sentencing guidelines has extensively been developed by the South African courts, and that extenuating circumstances and mitigating factors are part of the whole sentencing procedure, and it's not necessary to prescribe that specifically in the bill. That more or less concludes chapter 2 of the bill. The next chapter that's open is malicious communications, which is dealt with a bit more extensively.
Okay, any comments, questions on that chapter?
I think that would be the last chapter we deal with it before lunch. That concludes this matter for today, but I have before me a letter from the National Forum on Land Heritage and Human Rights, which is an invitation to the committee to attend a symposium at the University of Johannesburg on the 15th of November 2017. It's from Professor Quinton Johnson, the campus principal of Nelson Mandela University. And it addresses the critical question of land claims and the delays and problems attended thereto. And now we have here several universities that are involved, and I think that could be an opportunity for the committee to learn some, gain some insight that can help us to deal with this question, which has been bothering us for some time. And they're also inviting the Department of Justice, Department of Rural Development, Department of Agriculture. So we want to recommend that we attend this symposium at the University of Johannesburg on the 15th of November, and then we'll request the committee secretary to make the necessary arrangements for us. Are we happy with that? The convener is based at the Nelson Mandela University. They are working together with the University and University of Pretoria and in Transformation Initiative and Human Rights Foundation. We would actually also appeal to the department, because there are problems in the land claims court, which may throw the country into a crisis, that the department also send a high-powered delegation to this meeting. And they've also invited former judges. I think we need to find a solution to this question. Is the committee agreeable to the invitation? Silence means consent. Can we ask the committee secretary to make the necessary arrangements and request the department to convey this to their principals? Okay, thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
I found, oh.
Hi.